but it is at fixed low interest loans. It's an emergency program that SBA runs, and that will be the first step. If you didn't qualify for SBA, then FEMA has grants that cap out at about $34,000. But the reality is, for most people, they're going to probably get $6,000 to $7,000 to $8,000. That's about what average is. But each case is based upon what the needs are. So start the process by registering with FEMA, but understand that the tools may be SBA disaster loans or grants, in addition to providing temporary housing assistance.
You know, I just want to play a little bit of tape here. This is from CBS Face the Nation yesterday. It's the current FEMA director, Brock Long, talking about the situation right now.
This is a wake-up call. People cannot depend solely on the Federal Emergency Management Agency to be responsible for a majority. You know, states do a lot of work, but I think that we all have to collectively sit down after this event and figure out how to collectively improve.
Craig Fugate, it might surprise some people to hear the current FEMA director saying we've got to sit down and figure this out. I mean, after all these disasters, many you've been through, why hasn't stuff been figured out?
Well, I guess you have to go back to, what is the role of FEMA? Is it designed to replace the need for insurance, or is it designed to provide a lifeline to the next steps? Historically, when we have these big disasters, FEMA deals with the initial needs. But other agencies like Housing and Urban Development, Community Block Development grant dollars, are one of the ways that Congress has directed funds back into states to help rebuild homes that weren't insured and to help stabilize the housing markets. So it's really, I think, you know, going back to all these disasters is a fundamental question. Do we want the federal government to pay for all disaster costs and not have any insurance requirements? Or do we want to provide incentives and ways to help people begin recovery, but look at other federal programs that actually deal with longer-term issues, such as HUD, for full recovery? And that was the lesson we learned from Katrina, is you can't have one agency that's got all the answers. We have to really bring the federal family together and look at all the programs that can be out there.
How do you think Brock Long's agency is doing so far? How would you grade FEMA in response to Harvey?
I don't issue grades and during this response. You know, a lot of things that are going on, it's a disaster. You're going to see a lot of after action reports. We always learn from these things. But I think the critical thing is we're still got response operations, still have flooding. But as we start moving into recovery, is the initial steps of getting where people are going to stay. As they've talked about there in the school district, getting schools open, starting the initial recovery. And for people, it's like, right now, did I have insurance? And if I didn't, what do I do? Get your house mucked out, apply for assistance, and begin that process. This is not going to be quick, and that's why we need volunteers to donate generously their time and their money to help rebuild Houston and the other areas impacted.
We just have a few seconds left. What's it like to be a FEMA director at a moment like this when you have so many people relying on you?
It's a heavy lift, but you got a great team, and you're there to support the community, the governor, and that state.
All right. Craig Fugate is the former head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, joining us on Skype to talk about FEMA's response to Harvey right now. Thanks for your time this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
August was another violent month in Mexico. That says this year, the death toll has reached the highest level in more than two decades. And the violence is widespread, hitting cities once untouched by Mexico's drug war. One of those places is the tourist hotspot Los Cabos. 5 years ago, there was barely a murder a month there. Now, there's one nearly every day. As NPR's Kerry Kahn reports, the U.S. State Department has added Los Cabos to its most recent travel advisory.
The last weekend of August was a violent one in the southern tip of Mexico's Baja Peninsula. 16 people were murdered, according to local press accounts, in just 3 days.
Todos los días, uno, a veces dos funerales al día aquí.
Every day I go to one or two funerals, says Father Juan Martinez Lara. The local cemeteries are full, he adds. The murders don't stop on Sunday as the bell for Mass rings at his Church of the Divine Providence. Two women quietly approach Lara. Their uncle and a cousin were gunned down Saturday night, two of the 16 homicides of August's last weekend.
Entonces sí son dos realidades.
We live in two different realities, he says. There's the one up here in the dusty neighborhoods where water is only delivered once or twice a week, and another on the beaches where the tourists never go without. Since the beginning of the year, more than 230 people have been murdered in the state. That's a 250% jump in homicides over last year. Last month, the U.S. State Department updated its travel advisory to warn tourists about Los Cabos. Teresa Lyon of Phoenix, Arizona, came here on a cruise ship. She had seen the U.S. travel warning, but says she's not worried.
I think that if you're stupid and dumb, you're in the wrong places at the wrong time, and bad things can happen to you. If you're smart and you're paying attention to your surroundings, generally, Mexico's just perfectly safe to go to.
Officials say unlike places in Europe and Asia where tourists are being targeted, gangsters in Mexico just fight amongst themselves. Los Cabos is expected to hit a record 2 million visitors this year, the majority from the U.S. 20 new hotels are currently under construction, all votes of confidence on how safe the tourist spot is, say officials. But Los Cabos Mayor Arturo de la Rosa Escalante says while it may not be tourists being murdered, the violence is hurting Los Cabos.
Nosotros éramos espectadores, lo veíamos por televisión.
We used to be spectators. We just watched the violence in other parts of Mexico on TV, says De La Rosa. We never thought it would come here. But it did shortly after the fall of the head of the Sinaloa cartel, Chapo Guzman, especially after his extradition to the U.S. last year, says De La Rosa. Without Guzman at the head, the cartel splintered into smaller gangs that battle each other and the rival new Jalisco Generation cartel.
Un 90% es gente que está cruzando de Sinaloa.
90% of the people fighting here aren't from here, says De La Rosa. They come from nearby Sinaloa State. They come to fight and die here, he adds.
Okay, voy por la calle principal de Puerto Nuevo.
Reporter Cuauhtemoc Morgan is racing to the scene of the 16th murder of August's last weekend. He's getting directions over a radio. Morgan runs a local website documenting crime and corruption in Los Cabos. Earlier this year, one of his reporters was killed leaving a supermarket. Morgan is now enrolled in a federal protection program for journalists. By the time Morgan arrives to this poor hilltop neighborhood, yellow crime tape is up and an ambulance is leaving. One man was shot dead, another was gravely injured. A boy swings on a metal gym set atop a dirt patch in the middle of a traffic circle. This is the second shooting here in as many weeks. A few neighbors gather out in front the low-slung home set on dirt lots. This woman, who was too scared to give her name, says her son was also killed 3 weeks ago. She says he started selling drugs lured by the easy money. She says no one is doing anything to stop the violence, and she warns a crisis worse than the one we're living now is coming. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Los Cabos, Mexico.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 8:18, and you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad you could join us on this Labor Day morning. Coming up next in the WPR newscast, we'll hear the latest on a new state law that will launch a high school for teens struggling with addiction. More on the plan for the school and its timeline coming up in just a few minutes.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus, honoring personal legacies and the circle of life. Allow the compassionate, caring staff at Piasecki Althaus to take care of your funeral needs, serving the community since 1931.
We're on the air. NPR speaks in a voice you trust, and then we trust you to speak for yourself. This is NPR.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A decision is expected tomorrow from President Trump on whether he plans to end the Obama-era program known as DACA. It's something he promised to do when he ran for the White House. DACA prevents the deportation of those brought to the U.S. illegally as children. NPR's Vanessa Romo says Trump's announcement coincides with a looming lawsuit by 10 state attorneys general.
The deadline was set by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, who's demanding the administration sunset DACA, the executive order signed in 2012. The group contends the action exceeds the power of the executive branch. Only Congress, they say, can pass immigration legislation. Trump is widely expected to end DACA, which would remove legal protections for about 800,000 immigrants.
The head of one of the world's top public relations agencies has resigned. As Larry Miller reports from London, the British firm was cited for stoking racial tensions in South Africa.
James Henderson's position became untenable after Britain's PR trade body upheld a complaint that Bell Pottinger's campaign sowed racial division. The firm, hired by wealthy supporters of President Jacob Zuma, characterized South Africa's main opposition, the Democratic Alliance, as white monopoly capital. It's claimed the CEO was strongly advised against taking the account.
There's no trading today on Wall Street because of the Labor Day holiday. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Rachel Vasquez. The UW system is seeking proposals to create a recovery high school for teens struggling with addiction. Wisconsin currently only has one recovery school in Madison. This summer, Governor Scott Walker and lawmakers approved $50,000 for the four-year pilot project. Gary Bennett is with the Office of Educational Opportunity at UW System. Bennett says the school would support the educational and mental health needs of teens struggling with addiction.
It's open to any student who has been diagnosed with substance abuse disorder and has been in recovery for at least 30 days. So whether that addiction is opioids, which is sort of the most talked about right now, or alcoholism, which is extremely prevalent, unfortunately, amongst high school students, or any other drug.
The recovery school would enroll up to 15 students each year. Proposals must be submitted by early December. Leaders of the Joint Finance Committee have scheduled a vote on the $3 billion incentive package for Foxconn, and that will take place tomorrow at the Capitol. The Assembly has already given the bill its approval. A positive vote from the Budget Writing Committee would move the bill on to a vote from the full state Senate. The Finance Committee is scheduled to finish work on the state budget at the same time, but it's unclear if that will happen. Members are still working to deal with a shortfall in the transportation budget of nearly $1 billion. Governor Scott Walker has called for more borrowing and delaying some projects. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA believes smart financial decisions should enable life, not define it. TIAA calls this the new success story. Learn more at TIAA.org. From Jones Day, an integrated partnership collaboratively providing legal services for more than a century. 43 offices, 5 continents, serving clients as one firm worldwide. Learn more at jonesday.com. And from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, which publishes treatment results for 11 types of cancer, including quality of life ratings, to help patients and their caregivers make informed choices about their care. Learn more at cancercenter.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Today in your health, the dangers of too much sitting. But first, as health-conscious Americans try to cut back on sugar, Coca-Cola has turned its quest for alternative sweeteners into a competition. The company says it will award $1 million to the winner of its sweetener challenge. Although, as NPR's Allison Aubrey reports, coming up with a new sugar replacement will not be easy.
If you now think twice before reaching for a sugary drink, you're not alone. Darren Seifer is a food and beverage analyst with the NPD Group.
Sugar is now the number one item that consumers want to avoid in their diets.
Sales of carbonated soft drinks have taken a hit, Seifer says. And the problem for the beverage industry is that alternatives, such as artificially sweetened drinks, turn off many consumers too.
If the regular sodas are facing the backlash because they have too much sugars, then the diet colas are facing backlash because they contain a lot of artificial ingredients.
So why don't we have a sweetener that many of us are looking for? One that seems natural, tastes like sugar, but without the calories?
Well, this is a $100 million question. It's because it's so difficult and because it's so potentially lucrative. This is the big question.
That's Paul Breslin, a professor in the Nutritional Sciences Department at Rutgers University. He says there may be an urgency now, given sugar's role in obesity and type 2 diabetes, but looking for sugar alternatives?
The search for these is actually an old idea.
Remember Tab Cola, made with the sweetener saccharin? That was introduced back in 1963.
And there was a big push to identify other compounds that tasted better than saccharin. And so the chemists figured out how to generate these compounds to the tune of making many, many, many compounds that tasted sweet.
But there have been challenges for these artificial sweeteners, from safety questions to regulatory hurdles and taste. Breslin says when it comes to sugar, it's hard to trick the tongue.
Our love of sugar goes back, predating our species, to when we last shared a common ancestor with chimpanzees and apes. So yes, we have an ancient love of sugar.
Those ancestors ate a diet that included lots of fruit, and the natural sugars were a big source of energy. So Breslin says, from an evolutionary perspective, it makes sense that our brains and bodies would want to seek out the real thing.
When something doesn't match the profile of sugar, you don't even necessarily know why. You can't give voice to why it's not sugar. You just know something's off about it.
Moving forward, he says the quest for alternatives is moving away from the chemistry lab.
Right now, I think the searches are more focused on finding natural sweeteners that are naturally sourced, like plant compounds.
There are already several on the market, including stevia and monk fruit-based sweeteners. But so far, they're not as popular as beverage makers had hoped. Coca-Cola says to enter its sweetener competition, they're looking for novel compounds. And Paul Breslin says he's optimistic they're out there.
I'm sure that there are many more out there that we haven't found yet.
But finding a natural compound that can mimic the profile and taste of sugar, Breslin says, is a lot easier said than done. Alice Naubry, NPR News.
Okay, being a couch potato is not good for your health. No surprise there. But let's explore exactly what goes wrong if you sit around too much. It can increase your risk of heart disease and stroke. And new research finds that for people 50 and over, it can also make it more difficult to walk and even increase the odds of not being able to walk at all. Here's NPR's Patty Naimond.
If you don't routinely walk on the job, you can probably relate to Liz King. She's 61 years old and busy starting a vegan food company in Denver, but does it pretty much sitting down.
When you have your own business, you have a little more flexibility. But I'll tell you one thing that's constant is at least that 8 hours of looking at the screen and sitting in the chair.
After that, being glued to the computer doesn't necessarily stop.
The inbox, it's overflowing. An online class that I may be taking. Let me take care of a chat session or a group that I belong to.
Then there's about an hour of TV watching. It all adds up. In fact, epidemiologist Loretta DiPietro with George Washington University says lots of people do a lot more sitting. A 2-hour commute back and forth to a desk job plus evening TV time can easily top 13 hours of sitting, which is why DiPietro headed a study looking at how prolonged sitting affected older people's ability to get up and walk. She looked at federal data from questionnaires that asked more than 134,000 older people how much physical activity they did.
Walking, gardening, housework, exercises, recreational activities.
And even things that might seem pretty lightweight.
Puttering, walking to get the mail, or walking from a car.
She added up all the activity and compared it to how long people sat. Over 10 years, those who sat the most and moved the least had the greatest difficulty walking, saying they walked really slow or were unable to walk at all.
Those people had 3 times the risk compared with people in the highest physical activity category and reporting the lowest amount of sitting.
The biggest culprit in prolonged sitting? TV. Mostly because unlike in an office where you get up now and then and walk down the hall, when watching TV, many people just don't budge. DiPietro offers an antidote. Get up every 30 minutes.
At least like stand up, march in place, jump around, kick your legs.
For only about 1 or 2 minutes. A commitment to get moving is always good news for older people, says cardiologist Andrew Freeman with the American College of Cardiology.
The way we want people to exercise is to walk or exercise in whatever form to a level of breathlessness. And for some people, that's just walking at a slow pace.
Liz King breaks up her day with a 20-minute walk, longer on the weekends, and her pace, well, it varies.
If I'm walking solo, I'm probably walking at a more leisurely pace because I tend to take a picture of the occasional wildflower or the clouds that are in a wonderful formation.
In a group with people who are speedier, she keeps up. All a big win, says cardiologist Freeman, who says exercise is nature's best medicine. Patty Naimond, NPR News.
Support for your health comes from Novo Nordisk, dedicated to research and innovation to help millions of people living with diabetes. Learn more at novonordisk.us.
And this is NPR News.
Essayist Rachel Kadzi-Ganza went to Dylan Roof's house to talk to his dad.
You know, you're sitting there with, I think he had 2 100-pound Rottweilers, and my heart was just thumping.
But she kept at it. She wanted answers.
What had happened in this house that your son left here and killed elderly black people?
I'm Kelly McEvers, a profile of Dylan Roof, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 today here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And still to come this hour on Morning Edition, Mary Louise Kelly talks with reporter Charles Maines in Moscow about ongoing tensions between the U.S. and Russia. Both countries have recently closed diplomatic posts. We'll have more on the story coming up in about 15 minutes. It is 8:30. Good morning. This is Morning Edition on WPR. I'm Rachel Vasquez in for Maureen McCollum. In Wisconsin news, the Madison City Council will decide as early as this week what to do about a 4-foot-tall memorial to Confederate soldiers. It includes the names of 140 prisoners of war who died at Camp Randall in 1862. And Madison Mayor Paul Soglin says it's a, quote, slab of propaganda funded by a racist group. The monument was installed in 1931 when, according to the mayor, the city did not pay attention to the meaning of a fixture that honored, quote, slavery, sedition, and oppression. Soglin says it might be difficult to remove the monument from its current location at Forest Hill Cemetery, and he asked the city council to consider the matter at its meeting tomorrow night. Last month, Soglin had a smaller monument removed to Confederate troops as part of a debate that followed a violent white supremacist rally in Virginia to protest the removal of a Robert E. Lee statue. State investigators are reviewing a fatal shooting by a sheriff's deputy in Grant County. The Division of Criminal Investigation says the shooting happened after deputies went into a residence near Mount Hope last Friday to talk to a suspect. Authorities are not providing any other details about the circumstances surrounding the shooting. It took place Friday morning near Highway 18 and Clark Road. The deputy is on administrative leave per protocol. This is WPR News.
Support for WPR comes from The Bolt Company, providing professional construction services to customers in a variety of markets nationwide for more than 125 years. More about markets served, featured projects, and news is at bolt.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Ridgewood Care Center's annual Classic Car Motorcycle Show will take place Wednesday, September 20th. To show off your car or motorcycle, contact Bethany at 554-2236. Ridgewood is located at 3205 Wood Road in Mount Pleasant.
Thunderstorms are possible across northern Wisconsin today with a chance of showers and wind for much of the rest of the state, except for southwest Wisconsin, where it will be sunny. Highs will be in the mid-60s to high 70s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Carbonite, working to protect data from ransomware and other cyber attacks through automatic and secure cloud backup of data. Available for business and home computers and servers. Learn more at carbonite.com. From 4AD, presenting Sleep Well Beast, the new album from The National, available Friday on iTunes and Amazon. And from the Jack Kent Cook Foundation, providing scholarships to high-achieving students with financial need. JKCF.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly here in Washington, D.C. The UN Security Council is set to meet today, a day after North Korea conducted its sixth and most powerful nuclear test yet. President Trump gathered his national security team at the White House to discuss how to respond. Afterward, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said, if it comes to it, the president's options include, quote, total annihilation.
Any threat to the United States or its territories, including Guam, or our allies, will be met with a massive military response, a response both effective and overwhelming.
Pyongyang says the bomb tested yesterday was a hydrogen bomb. That has not been confirmed, but it does look like this one was much more powerful than any bomb North Korea has tested so far. NPR's Elise Hugh is following this story from across the border in Seoul, South Korea. She's on the line now. Hey, Elise.
Hey there.
How does this weekend's test change the stakes in this crisis?
Well, it does and it doesn't. It doesn't change things in that all of us in this region were fully expecting this sixth test to happen at some point. North Korea has been consistently trying to test and improve its program, and it has to test in order to improve. And the regional actors here, as well as the U.S., really haven't changed and diverted from the typical playbook between last year's test in September and this recent one. And so without a dramatic new move, the course didn't change.
Okay, now, so that's how it didn't change. How does the course change by all
that's
this?
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, it does worsen the situation if regional players are reading the fast advances of the North Korean program and then decide to act differently. And what we mean by differently is it could embolden those in Japan who want to build up militarily, conventional arms even. Or does it drive the U.S. into taking more seriously into consideration military options? And that's despite all of the catastrophic collateral damage that it could trigger.
Sure. So that's what could happen on the military front. Now, what about on the economic front? Recently, the UN passed new sanctions, sanctions that do not appear to be reining in North Korea's nuclear ambitions one bit. What else might world leaders do at this point to address the situation?
Well, even despite the spotty enforcement of sanctions and the poor record so far, we are likely to see more pressure on Pyongyang in the form of even more sanctions. But at the same time, there's going to be more pressure in the form of the saber rattling and shows of force and just more talk of military options, as we heard from Jim Mattis previously. So there was already a show of force earlier today here on the peninsula in the form of surface-to-surface missiles launched by South Korea.
Okay.
Japan is talking about what else it can do to isolate North Korea unilaterally. And what we're not hearing about, though, is any talk about direct negotiations with Pyongyang, which would be a diplomatic, non-military option to confront this crisis. President Trump has tweeted recently that talking is not the answer. However, South Korea would be most interested in finding a peaceful solution, considering our proximity here to the North.
Speaking of South Korea, President Trump seemed to take aim at South Korea. He was tweeting following this nuclear test and saying South Korea should not try to appease North Korea. Why criticize South Korea, and why now?
Yeah, it's unclear, and it's not being received well in Seoul, where the National Security Council here has already sought clarification from Washington on that tweet. And when you want partners in isolating North Korea, alienating a key longtime ally seems like a strange way to go about things.
That's NPR's Elise Hugh talking to us there from Seoul. Thanks, Elise.
You bet.
And let's return now to Houston, where there are still areas of that city where the water is so high, people can't get back into their homes. NPR's Rebecca Davis visited one neighborhood where people are hoping they can finally figure out how much they've lost.
On the edge of a parking lot, a small group of people stand around. At first, it looks like they could be waiting for a bus, but actually, they're waiting for a boat. Over the past few days, volunteers have been showing up here to ferry people to their homes so they can survey the damage. Sergeant Ron Rayburn, Harris County Precinct 5, watches from his patrol car. This is a quiet neighborhood, brick homes, nice lawns. He says it had just recovered from a major flood last year, and now many of those fixed-up homes are ruined again.
Just in this section back here, we have about 2,000 homes, and I would estimate probably 1,500 of them or a little more have been flooded, some of them at least 7 feet of water in them.
A few minutes later, a couple of boats return with passengers. People get off, others get in. Sergeant Rayburn wishes they wouldn't. The water is just too dangerous.
There are alligators in here. There's still electricity in there, which we've had someone had gotten electrocuted on Tuesday walking in the water.
And sometimes the water is a weird green. Today, it's brown.
I mean, I've been here a little while. I'll just wait as long as it takes.
Jana Caruana hopes she'll be next.
I'm not going home without Cupcake.
The family cat. Janet promised her daughter she would find Cupcake. Like everyone here, Janet's not only dying to get back home, she's nervous like crazy about what she'll find.
Well, I think once I see that house, once I see the inside, it's going to be like I'm going to realize how much devastation I'm facing.
A guy named Steve comes up in his boat. Janet gets in, and off we go.
So it's the next street after this.
Everywhere is water. It's peaceful, but Janet's garage door is open.
That's weird.
Steve pulls his boat up to her house, and Janet looks down at the water. She worries she'll get electrocuted.
That's what I'm afraid of. Oh, well. One way of getting out of paying all my bills that I owe.
She sticks her finger in the water, and Steve chuckles. If that were electric, you'd be dead by now. She steps into the water and walks into the garage. She nearly slips on the muck. There's a water line 2 feet up the wall, but no standing water.
Kitty girl! Man, it stinks in here. It's very musty.
She buzzes around the house looking everywhere for Cupcake.
She's not here. I don't see her.
Janet calms herself. Okay, she's somewhere. Cats are resilient. As for the house, it's soggy, yes, but not a total loss. Janet was preparing herself to say goodbye to her home. But now?
I'm thinking now, you know, as soon as I get that water out, maybe we can just go back to my home and just, you know, start to rebuild, you know, just getting some semblance of normalcy again.
Back at the street corner, others still wait. It's late afternoon, and the boat captains are getting tired. I'll be back tomorrow, one of them says, and the day after that. Rebecca Davis, NPR News, Houston.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 8:41. Glad you could be with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. News headlines are just ahead from NPR and then in the WPR newscast. Last week's Hurricane Harvey is starting to impact gas prices. WPR's Rich Kramer tells us what that impact looks like in Wisconsin. That's coming up in a few minutes.
Let's Draw had very specific rules about drawing in 1937.
Here are a few tricks that make it ever so much more fun. First, don't lean over your desk as if you were doing the hardest, most awful work in the world. Let's all sit up straight and smile while we're drawing.
WPR, celebrating our first 100 years.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The UN Security Council is holding an emergency meeting today to consider new sanctions on North Korea. This follows Pyongyang's latest nuclear test, its sixth in 11 years. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin says the Trump administration is putting together new sanctions designed to cut off trade with North Korea.
The president has made it clear this isn't the time for just talk, this is time for action, that this type of behavior is not acceptable.
Mnuchin was speaking to Fox News Sunday. Switzerland's president says her country is willing to act as a mediator to try to resolve the dispute over North Korea's nuclear program. China is lodging a protest with the North Korean embassy in Beijing over this latest nuclear test. NPR's Rob Schmitz is in Shanghai.
The North's sixth and most powerful nuclear test so far happened on the eve of an important summit China's hosting of the world's largest emerging economies. Some analysts believe the timing was no coincidence and that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un aimed to push Chinese President Xi Jinping into brokering talks between the North and the United States to draw down U.S. military forces in South Korea.
Hurricane Irma remains a major Category 3 storm as it continues to move westward toward the islands of the northeastern Caribbean. A hurricane watch is posted on islands including St. Kitts and St. Martin. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Rachel Vasquez. Gas prices are going up after Hurricane Harvey shut down a number of South Texas oil refineries. But as Rich Kramer reports, Wisconsin gas prices aren't likely to rise as much as the national average.
According to energy analytics firm IHS, Hurricane Harvey knocked nearly all oil refineries along the Texas coast offline. Global head of energy analysis Tom Closa says many are restarting, but electric outages could keep some refineries from hitting full capacity for a couple weeks. Closa says this is driving up wholesale gasoline prices, which will drive up consumer prices.
I'm looking at a likely sort of stopping point or a peaking action somewhere between $2.60 and $2.75 a gallon nationally, which would be, you know, the highest prices of the year.
While Texas refineries don't supply Wisconsin with gas, the southern demand for fuel will mean less supply for the Midwest. GasBuddy.com estimates Wisconsin prices could go up another 5 to 10 cents per gallon before the market. market stabilizes. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A Wisconsin lawmaker has resurrected his bill calling for stripping repeat drunken drivers of their licenses for at least a decade. Republican Senator Van Wongard's proposal calls for revoking licenses of anyone who commits four or more drunken driving offenses, or anyone who commits two or more offenses and has at least two convictions for serious crimes involving a vehicle. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Exxon and Mobil, with Synergy Gasoline engineered in Exxon Mobil's Formula One fuel lab. Exxon and Mobil, energy lives here. From Charles Schwab, offering Schwab Intelligent Advisory, an interactive online financial planning service that combines technology with personal advice. Learn more at schwab.com/intelligentadvisory. And from the Jacob and Valeria Langloth Foundation, supporting the health and well-being of underserved populations at langloth.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Just how bad are relations between the U.S. and Russia right now? Well, over the weekend, the U.S. took control of Russia's consulate in San Francisco. That follows a move by Moscow, ordering the U.S. to slash its diplomatic staff in Russia by hundreds, which followed the U.S. throwing 35 Russian diplomats out of the country last year, which followed Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. You get the picture. On the line now from Moscow is reporter Charles Maines. Hey, Charles.
Hi, Mary Louise. Good to be with you.
And with you. So start with this question. Does the diplomatic tit for tat end here, or might Russia retaliate against this latest U.S. retaliation?
Well, you know, Russia hasn't made clear exactly what their response will be at this point. They say they don't want to give in to emotions, but clearly their anger is apparent here. They've been calling this state hooliganism. They've called it an act of hostility. I think beyond the anger over the compound seizure, the row seems now to be focused on what happens to these facilities now that they've been handed over to American officials. Russia has been accusing the U.S. of essentially letting the FBI sweep the premises, suggesting that they could be planting cameras or microphones or compromised materials. The State Department today said that's not the case. That's really a question, I think, of whether the Russians will take them at their word, the early signs being no.
And we were quite literally watching smoke signals here in the U.S. these last few days as smoke came out of the chimney in the Russian consulate in San Francisco. We don't know quite what was happening there. We do know that, meanwhile, we've got two new ambassadors at the helm, a new American ambassador in Moscow and Russia's new ambassador, who has just arrived here in Washington. This is Anatoly Antonov. What do we know about him?
Well, you know, Antonov is 62 years old. He's considered a hardliner, a specialist in arms control. You know, essentially, he's a tough guy for a tough assignment. He's a former deputy defense minister. But that, you know, said he gave an interview to state television here before he departed for Washington, where he really said kind of all the right things. He was very diplomatic, said he was very eager to engage the American press. He wants to end the sanctions spiral, says he prefers diplomacy to conflict. You know, and keep in mind that his predecessor, Sergei Kislyak, became, you know, if not a household name, but close to it because of the Russiagate scandals.
Certainly a man about town here in Washington, meeting with just about everybody, it seemed.
Exactly. But towards the end of his tenure there, he really was sort of toxic. He couldn't meet anybody in the sort of American establishment, political establishment, without being outed by the press. And now Antonov says he wants to kind of change that. He wants to travel the country, engage Americans. He also says he's a big fan of jazz and country music, so hopefully he'll get to a club or two.
Okay, so he's got that going for him here in Washington. We do, against this backdrop, I just want to mention Russian President Putin has been in China. He met with President Xi last night. They talked North Korea. They apparently talked about how to deal with North Korea. Do we know what they may have agreed?
Well, the two met last time in July in Moscow, and they've been pushing a de-escalation deal for the Korean Peninsula. The idea here being that the North Koreans would suspend their ballistic missile program, and the U.S. and South Korea would put a moratorium on military drills. Now, obviously, none of that's happened. Both sides have continued to push forward. But that's Russia's main message here, is kind of dialogue. Putin was in China. He said that threats are a road to nowhere. And it's important to note that Russia's also come out against further sanctions against North Korea today. Mm-hmm. The deputy foreign minister said that they'd reached the limit of their impact and would just essentially break the North Korean economy. So, you know, it looks as though the Russians essentially are pushing for dialogue.
All right. That's reporter Charles Maines reporting us on all the diplomatic developments to do with Russia, talking to us from Moscow. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
It is 10 minutes before 9 o'clock, and classical music starts in 15 minutes here on Wisconsin Public Radio. But up next on Morning Edition, the Kenrotop microwave is turning 50 years old. Coming up, we look at the science, history, and cultural impact of the microwave oven. That's in 10 minutes. Stay with us.
WGTD is on your smartphone. For local news and the rest of the mobile version of our website, log on to WGTD.org. For live audio streams of WGTD, 24/7 Jazz HD2, and SportsWeb, visit the App Store and download the free WGTD app.
WPR is pleased to support live music performance. For more information, go to WPR.org/events.
Thunderstorms are possible across northern Wisconsin today with brief gusty winds and small hail as the day goes on. There's a chance of showers and wind for much of the rest of the state, except for southwest Wisconsin, where it will be sunny today. Highs will be in the mid-60s to high 70s. You're listening to WPR News.
Support for WGTD comes from Andrea's. It's patio season, which means al fresco dining at Jack's Cafe. Stop by and enjoy the sun along with one of their breezy summer cafe specials. Updated daily at andreasgifts.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
I'm David Green, and this is our co-host Rachel Martin with a searing question.
When's the last time you used your microwave? Probably this morning, right? Maybe you warmed up some leftover pizza for breakfast, nuked your coffee that wasn't warm anymore. Microwaves are so ubiquitous, we take it for granted that every house and every apartment will come with one. This year, the countertop microwave celebrates its 50th anniversary. And whether you love it or loathe it, you cannot deny the influence this machine has had on American life.
It cooks most everything in about 1/4 the time, so you use less electricity. The food.
This is a commercial for the Amana Radar Range, which first came out in 1967. It is the microwave that made nuking your food as routine as brushing your teeth.
But remember, if it doesn't say Amana, it's not a radar range.
It was called the Radar Range because the technology for microwave cooking came from radar. It was the result of a happy accident by an engineer working for a defense contractor back in the 1940s.
The man who discovered this was Percy Spencer, and he was working at Raytheon.
That's Timothy Jorgensen. He's an associate professor of radiation medicine at Georgetown University.
He was working with an instrument called a magnetron, which is the heart of a radar instrument, and he had a candy bar in his front pocket, so he noticed that the candy bar was starting to melt.
Spencer tried an experiment. He took the magnetron and shot some radio waves at a raw egg.
And the egg quickly heated and exploded.
Exploded.
Exploded. And then he got some popcorn kernels, and he got the popcorn kernels to pop. So you can see where this is going. And in fact, Raytheon went on to patent the microwave oven.
Microwave cooking units are indeed revolutionary. Desserts frozen solid like Swiss chocolate cake, thawed and ready to eat in 5 seconds.
We should say earlier attempts at microwaves didn't catch on. They were way too big, way too expensive, and the dishes came out looking kind of gross.
It didn't make the food brown like people were used to seeing in the oven. So there were spray-on things that you would spray on meat and things like that. So it would
wait to make it look like it had grill marks.
Yeah, to make it look like it had cooked in the oven.
Ew,
yeah.
Creepy. In the 1970s, manufacturers tried to counter the creepy with public service campaigns that made microwave cooking seem downright fancy.
A special delight for lobster lovers is the way these elegant lobster tails broil to perfection in just 7 minutes.
We're walking in the back hallways of the Smithsonian to see one of the early models of the tabletop microwave. Oh, you do need extra security to go in here. Is this it?
Yes, this is it.
Wow, this is beautiful.
Yes. Yep.
No touching. Oh, I'm sorry.
there it was, situated on a table in a storage room at the Smithsonian's American History Museum, an early Amana radar range in all of its retro metallic glory. Curator Laura Simo, who knows the rules about no touching, puts on blue rubber surgical gloves.
We'll open this up so you can just appreciate the beauty.
That is magical.
You should walk around. You know, we put it out in the middle of the room so you can enjoy it in the round.
I appreciate, yes, in the round.
In the round, yes. It's really
exciting.
You
are well suited to your job. Simo was excited about this radar range, not just because it was so well preserved, but because the woman who donated it to the museum kept all the original owner's manuals and brochures.
You know, I love the introduction, like, welcome to the world of microwave cooking. It's not only a time saver, it also is a solution to the energy crisis.
Huh, that's fascinating.
You save 50 to 75% of the electricity you normally use in cooking. In the early 70s, it's now an energy-saving device.
Okay, saving the planet aside, one of the biggest turnoffs of the microwave oven is that the food that comes out never really seems that appetizing.
That's it.
That's a cake?
That's a cake.
Let's just say this is not...
It's not
pretty.
It is
not aesthetically pleasing.
It's sort of like an alien tube rising, but I'm going to zhuzh it up.
That's Joe Yonan. He's the food and dining editor for The Washington Post. He came to the Morning Edition break room to convince me that microwaves are for more than just heating up last night's pasta. And to be fair, after he spooned on some cream and strawberries with a little basil garnish, this would be the zhuzh, he had turned that alien blob into a truly delicious strawberry shortcake. Yonan says the key is understanding what these machines do well.
If you think about it, a microwave is targeting water. It's heating up the water molecules in the food. So steaming is great. Green beans. So I have a pretty big bowl. This is about a half a pound of beans. And I'm just going to put a splash of water.
Oh, that's really not very much. Okay.
Let's just go for maybe a couple minutes and see how they look.
Fast forward through the magic of radio.
So that looks pretty good.
Those look like they're supposed to.
They're not mushy.
Can I eat one? Sure. This tastes really good.
And you don't eat this and think that was a microwaved green bean.
Definitely not.
You know, that's part of our, I think, prejudice about microwaves is that we assume that everything that it touches turns to mush.
Okay, fine. He steams some green beans. Big deal. Show me something really impressive. Joe was up for the challenge. He said he had never tried this recipe before, but he was willing to risk it all on the radio and attempt to make, dun-da-da-dun, microwave potato chips.
So this is just a red potato, and I have a little handheld mandolin to get the slices really thin. Now I'm going to spray the plate so they don't stick.
Okay, so that's just what, olive oil?
That's just an olive oil spray.
Okay.
I am going to... salt these.
Oh, yes. I was going to be so upset if you didn't want to put salt on it. It's the whole point of a potato chip.
Right. We're going to do it for a couple of minutes and watch to see if they start to brown.
After about 2 minutes, Joe flipped each potato slice over, and here's where the real culinary skill comes in. He then nuked them for another couple minutes. Oh! Oh, those look really good. I am impressed with the browning, I gotta say. Get out of town.
Right? It works.
Yeah. Eureka! They're so good. Now, here's where you cannot get cocky. Joe says just because you can make chips in the microwave doesn't mean you can pull off, say, a pork loin or even a hamburger. Unless you're stuck on a desert island and the only machine you have is a microwave, don't use it to cook meat. So if you have learned anything here today, sure, the microwave is 50 years old, but the real lesson is that if you trust your microwave, if you look through the little glass door and say, I believe in you, it might just make you a damn good potato chip.
That was Rachel Martin on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And you can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And join us at 3, 4, more on the day's news on BBC NewsHour, followed by All Things Considered at 4 o'clock. It is 1 minute before 9 o'clock. Stay with us. Headlines and music are coming up next.
Support for WPR comes from Titletown Brewing Company in Green Bay, now offering a variety of bottled beers throughout Wisconsin. More about their beers, historic facilities, and newly renovated brewery is at TitletownBrewing.com.
Support comes from the Broggy Coffee House and Wine Bar, offering fresh organic coffee and espresso drinks, affordable wines and beer, live music, and delicious dishes. Broggy is still in Williams Bay, but it's at a new location, 107 North Walworth Avenue. Visit BroggyCoffeeWineMusicArt.com.
You're listening to WGTD.